Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards that are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam, which for understandable reasons is often shortened to DJ. Today, my guest is Jacob Argaard. Jacob is a grandmaster. He was the British champion in 2007, but most of you will know him as a prolific and successful writer, the publisher of chess books at Quality Chess, and a top coach who has worked with many big names we know, and no doubt various that have remained a secret. Jacob has authored more than 20 books, and he's the only chess author to have won all four major chess book awards. I invited Jacob to speak about Mark Dvoretsky, the legendary coach and writer, who was a friend of his and a great inspiration. The occasion is the publication of the book Chess Coach, The Profound and Lasting Influence of Mark Dvoretsky by New in Chess, a tribute to Dvoretsky compiled by Vladimir Basky that first appeared in Russian. Hello, Jacob. Thank you for joining us. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. I'm very well, and I'm very excited to talk about I think two of my favorite topics, which is Mark Dvoretsky and chess training.
Very good. Well, you're a busy man, combining coaching, writing, running a company, organizing training camps, and whatnot. What's the focus on this week or these weeks?
The focus at the moment is on business. And it's much more than one company, but that's maybe a discussion for another time.
All right. Well, then let's turn to the book Chess Coach about Mark Dvoretsky. For the listeners, the book is divided in four sections. There are tributes by people who worked with him. Then there's games and studies. And finally, there are articles by Dvoretsky and interviews with him. Well, Jacob, you're also featured in the tribute section, calling him the biggest authority in my adult life. That is quite something.
Yeah, actually, there was the funny thing. When you contacted me about this podcast, I was like, New Chess is doing a book about Mark Dvoretsky, and they didn't speak to me about contributing to it. And I was thinking, why? Like, why?
Yeah.
And then when I realized it's a translation of a book that was written, half a decade ago.
Yeah.
I also realized when I opened it, I actually did contribute to it. So I thought that was quite entertaining, from at least on a personal level.
Okay.
Without going into too much of my own history, I never knew my biological father, and sort of that's been a little bit of a messy thing. But at the time where I needed someone to help me with my next steps from being, you know, a student, chess player, I am sort of not knowing how to continue, a little bit lost, and also starting writing books, is when I met Dvoretsky, and he was still so always very giving with advice, and also with the support, the mental support. Yeah, you do this, you'll be fine, you'll be fine, mm-hmm. you'll be fine. And
did he realize that you were looking for that kind of advice?
No, not at all. You know, I had a conversation with Yusupov about the time when Dvoretsky told him he would take him on as his student. He should maybe tell it himself, but the key point I remembered Yusupov's a great surprise, because he had already thought that Mark was his coach for a long time because of various things that had worked on. But it was a very different experience to work with him one-on-one and privately, and not just in the, I think it was maybe the Pioneer Palace or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not a great authority on these Russian structures. I do want to say one thing about your opening thing that I think is quite relevant to this discussion is, I was the only one. Now maybe other awards should be counted in, but I won the ECF, the FIDE Award, the PCA, and the Chess Cafe. Now the last two are now defunct, so nobody can catch me on that. And the only reason why I was the only one to win all four is because Chess Cafe at the time was owned by Hannon Russell, who also owns Russell's publication, and and published a string of excellent books, a lot of them by Mark Drechsky. Hmm. And for entirely understandable ethical reasons, he thought he couldn't both count the votes and be in the competition. So books published by Russell were not eligible. And for that reason, Drechsky never won this award, but he won all the others. So for this is the technical reason why I'm the only one who won all these awards.
Well, and a valid correction of history. I mean, that...
We have the great authors. Drechsky and Nunn sort of stand out for me as... And then we have other great authors who were also absolute top players. Kasparov, Tal, Botvinnik come to mind first. But for players who... Not I'm saying Nunn was not a top player and Drechsky was like 35 in the world and beat Smyslov and stuff. But you know, they were not at the very, very peak. Like you could also say Gelfand in there, who I co-wrote a series of books with.
But then you put the peak at quite some height because, let's say, John Nunn played World Cup tournaments. And I mean, he was a very strong player, obviously.
No. You have a lot of strong. But I'm just, for me, like Drechsky and Nunn are sort of the big writers who were not like world champions or world championship match players. So. Yeah.
Let's go to that moment when you met Mark Tveretsky. You say that he gave you valuable advice. Were you already thinking of writing books when you met him?
I had already written Panov Botvinnik Attack and maybe written the Sveshnikov. But through the time when I was writing the Selling a Chess series, we had sort of discussions about them afterwards. And you can also, if you read the books, you can see there's actual training sessions I've had with Mark referenced in the books. But his influence was much bigger on a later book, which is by far my most successful book commercially, which is Grandmaster Preparation Calculation. From the beginning when I was talking to him, so I met him first in 99 and I visited him sometimes in Moscow, and he visited me in Copenhagen. Later when I moved to UK, he visited in Glasgow. So he was talking for a long time that somebody should do an exercise book where the exercises were divided into the themes, not on the board, but in the thinking you should apply to it. And at some point I had this material, and I told this many times, we had a cash flow issue in the quality chess. It was minor, and usually we solved it by John paying the bills and then we're paying him back later. But I could see there was a cash flow issue on the horizon. I thought I can very quickly put some exercises together that I collected for Gelfand, who I was helping at the time. And then we put out some book and, you know, some tactical theme calculation or something. And then I remembered this Mark had said, and I asked him, you know, do you mind if I use your idea because you haven't used it yourself? And he said, no, I can't be bothered. You know, I'd much rather read books and watch TV. So I wrote the book, and it has been very, very popular, and it was his idea. So blame it on him.
Yes, but then let's say your later books, or the way you worked as a writer, that was strongly influenced by the way he worked on his books and his coaching. Is that fair to say?
Well, yes, I view chess through a lens where, let's say it in the way that I maybe graduated from a bachelor degree at Mark Drechsky University, and later I studied for a master's and a PhD on my own. But it does not mean that the origin has not influenced me greatly. I have my own ideas about a lot of things, but a lot of the approaches are from Mark, the stuff I learned from Mark, or I learned from Yusupov, who learned them from Mark and was using his material to a great extent. If you read Yusupa's 10 books, orange and blue and green books, which is the right reading order. A lot of the material is from Mark, and of course, perfectly with Mark's permission to use it.
Mm-hmm.
This is one thing that people don't realize, just how influential he was on chess literature. When Kasparov wrote the first predecessor's book with Ronkov, Dretzky, he saw it and he had a lot of issues with it, with the sort of the variations and material, and he contacted Ronkov and said, I think this might even be sort of close to a quote. It's made up, but it could be close to a quote. "You idiots, why didn't you contact me? Obviously, I've analyzed all these games, and obviously, I will just share my analysis with you." So he, in the first few books, he sort of was working together with Ronkov, which is quite interesting because on a personal level, he was not a big Kasparov fan. They have known each other from Gary's childhood when Dvoretsky was an assistant coach at the Botvinnik school, and later Kasparov and Dolmatov and Yusupov were all competing, and Yusupov and Dolmatov always were on reasonable terms with Kasparov, but Dvoretsky always had sort of reservations, and later Kasparov didn't like Dvoretsky because he turned off as the second for almost anyone Kasparov was playing against. which was a coincidence, which was not a...
Yeah.
It was not like... But what Marx thought about these books, the predecessor's books, were this is such an important piece of chess history that everyone should be interested in them being as good as possible.
Mm.
And it doesn't matter if the guy who is writing them is maybe not his closest friend, or let's say it like that. It's not like he hated him or something. But it was just...
But there was always this friction, right?
Yeah, there was always a friction. And you could also see it from Kasparov's side. You know, whenever you play someone, this guy's on the other side. And... Mm. Was it when he beat Anand, he said, I've defeated the Dvoretsky system, which is funny because Dvoretsky was
in New York in 95, the match.
So Dvoretsky showed up for like a 2-day training session with Anand that lasted 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Because it was like Anand didn't really want to engage and thought, okay. Yeah.
But don't
so
you
they
think
just
that
hang out and exchange stories.
But don't you think there's at least a grain of truth in the fact that it's in a way it was getting back at him? I mean, he was removed from the Botvinnik School of Chess. It's easy to understand why Kasparov felt like that. I mean, he was there on the other side very often.
Well, he wasn't there that often. Like he was, you know, with his students when Kasparov was growing up, because there was sort of this age difference that made it natural that Dvoretsky as a coach would train Kasparov's competitors. But I don't think there was any consideration from Dvoretsky that this was about Kasparov. It was always, Dvoretsky was always about the student himself and if he got along well with the student. There was one famous grandmaster who was coaching, and I don't want to say who he felt was the greatest talent he ever worked with.
Mm.
But he didn't like his father and he didn't like sort of the family dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So he quit working with them for that reason. And
because it's
just for life quality, I think.
But it's funny when I was thinking about the book and our talk, then I remembered there was a time, I think it was the last time that Salov played in Vaikansei, and I walked into the press room together with Gena Sozonko, and Mark was there and he was talking to Salov, and Gena and I, we just looked at each other and we laughed and said, "Guess what they are talking about," and we both fully understood. This was our first thought. Okay, they are talking about Kasparov, and of course they were.
Yeah, well, I don't want to go into why it's weird these two were talking to each other, but
no.
but those who know will know that's quite weird.
Yeah. No. Well, the first part of the book are these tributes by various players, and it says a lot about Dvoretsky, but it also says a lot about these people who tell their stories. And about the closeness that many of his pupils felt with him. I mean, it gives you a very warm feeling. Is that something that was a prevalent feeling for you too? I mean,
oh yes. So the first time I went to Moscow to visit Mark was possibly 2001, and I went for a training camp, and I was paying and so on. And then, you know, he had this additional flat next, sort of in the building, a few 500 meters from his own that I was going to be staying. And so after the training session, the first day, you know, he took me over to the flat, so on and so on. He said, oh, make yourself comfortable and enjoy yourself and so on. And okay, I thought, okay, this was a nice training session. And I had arrived very early in the morning, so we started working first day. And now, you know, I unpacked and I was thinking, okay, what should I do? I could sit and study something. I was on. And then, you know, at some point there was this noise, and there was a electronic noise. And at some point I realized, okay, there's a phone here somewhere calling. And it was then Mark calling, like, where are you? Why are you not coming back for dinner? And I had sort of been thinking, how should I get something to eat or something?
Yeah.
Where I was thinking of this as a like professional relationship. I come, I have some lessons, I pay some money, and he puts me up in this flat, which is very nice of him. And then, you know, when the lessons is over, like, you go to your own place, yeah?
Yeah.
But no, now the whole thing started, and I went there every night for, I don't know, more than the training session, for, you know, dinner and talking and so on. And I think probably that was much more valuable for me than the chess, because to me, you know, it was like I really looked up to him a lot, and being engaged as a as an equal, I would say. Still, I was young, he was older, and he was experienced, and I was green, and there were things I disagreed with him then that I might agree with now, but.
But then what were you talking about? I mean, chess.
Oh, everything. We were talking about chess. We were talking about culture. We were talking about books. We were talking about chess books. We were talking about other kind of books. We were talking about movies. We were talking about politics. We were talking about history. We were, you know, chatting. It was very enriching.
Yeah. Well, it's something that many of his other students that they mentioned, that he was the one who introduced them to the forbidden writers in the Soviet Union, the ones you were not supposed to read. That was an essential part of him, his independence of thought in general matters as well.
No, he was telling a lot of stories from the Soviet times. He said once that they had taken to they'd gone to I think Groningen, and then they had taken a taxi from the train station, from the airport to the train station in Netherlands, or something like that.
Yeah.
And they had to get it reimbursed. And I can't remember exactly why, but there was all kind of problems with it. So in the end, he was like, you know, we took a taxi from the train station to the airport because the train station is outside Amsterdam. So he sort of made up that rather than the airport is outside Amsterdam, he sort of put the airport in the middle of the city, just to show how stupid the system was, and it got signed off.
Yeah.
Also, another story I remember he told me about the time, so which maybe for younger people will not make so much sense, but it was, I'm so bad with name. What's the big Russian writer, dissident at the time?
Solzhenitsyn.
Absolutely. He said, you know, the story at the time was that Solzhenitsyn had been arrested in the airport because they had found in his lockers Mark Taimanov's book on the Nemtso Indian. while in reality, what had happened was Mark Taimanov had been arrested in the airport because they, and the excuse was that they had found a Solzhenitsyn book.
Yeah.
Actually, what had really happened was that Taimanov had lied about the amount of money he was bringing with him to the Soviet Union. And the reason why he had lied about the money was because he had taken some aside to give to his mistress. Mm. And he didn't want his wife to know. So there was lots of these stories from Mark.
Well, and it probably didn't help that he came back from his match against Fischer.
6-0, yeah, 6-0, yeah, yeah. Like they wanted somehow to be it, not that Fischer was good, but that Taimanov was a traitor.
Yeah.
Which didn't make sense, but.
What struck me as I said, it also says a lot about the people who wrote these tributes. One that struck me was Sergei Dolmatov when he said that in a junior tournament in 1977 in Leningrad, he fell ill. And then Dvoretsky, he went to hospital with him. And, well, they started to treat him. And Dolmatov, he thought, okay, you can go now. But he stayed. And he stayed for a month. And I thought that was very touching and telling.
Yeah, it's he was very, like, he had two ways later, because I knew him in the period where he sort of became famous and wouldn't say wealthy, but he made some money from books and training programs and so on. And I knew him in that period, and there he had this approach to students, that he had some students like me that he would charge some money. It was really, like, sometimes when I told people what I paid him, they were like, we're going to Moscow right now. where's the airport?
Yeah,
I think it was like 50 euros at the time or something. Then he made some money. They bought this extra flat and so on, and his wife was, by the way, she was, it doesn't say so in the book, but she was at the very top of a Moscow bank towards the end of her career and was doing very, very well. Mm-hmm. But so he had this thing that he would charge normal prices from people, and he would be nice and so on. But then he had his real students, his own students. He never charged them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of them tried to give him money, and it's just no.
So then we're talking Yusupov, Dolmatov, Zvaginchev.
Zvaginchev, Inakiev, Popov. I don't know if some of them managed to give him something. Bologan maybe also worked very closely with him for a period. But he saw that as a project. And for me also, this is how I have approached my work as a trainer. Yeah, this is the thing I also learned from him, is do it for the value of it, the intrinsic value of it.
Is that, well, a crucial element of his personality, let's say his humanity, the way he saw life and led his life?
I think it benefited his personality to some extent that money didn't really exist. In when he was growing up, and nobody had money. You know, Spassky was a world champion and living in a one-bedroom apartment. Some might have a little more than others, but only people who he entirely despised had any kind of wealth, and that's people who are, yeah, he would call them maybe collaborators with the with the dictatorship. And therefore, you know, you seek other values, but in general, he was just a very caring person. In the book, he also his son writes about how his father was not interested in him as a chess player, and maybe not as a little child. And I could see that because Dvoretsky was an intellectual. Like, he's someone who liked to have conversations. But he always was very, in the situations I saw, he was always very affectionate and respectful of his son and so on. It's not like he didn't care for him. I think more like, the things he could offer became relevant later, and when the sun was ready, then they were there. Yeah, but he cared a lot about people. Like he would send me, oh, this player we was at this camp that you organized, he played well in this tournament and so on. Mm-hmm. But other times he would be, you could see his laziness turn true. Mm-hmm. We had a camp in Glasgow where one player would say, oh, if he's interested in looking at my games, you know, I've sent some games. I present to Marcus, no, he can go to Fritz, you know, I don't care. No interest.
I mean, there had to be some rapport, some link between them.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember from his book For Colleagues and Friends, where he wrote about his adventure with George Waitzkin, and that this was a total mismatch because their ideas of what they were going to do and how he assessed him as a player was so totally different.
Yes, I think this is and this is also a very important thing I learned from him, that when you're working with a student, it has to be right for both. It really has to be. And recently I was asked by the secretary of a leader of a country if I wanted to provide chess lessons. And my soul was just heavy, like I really didn't want to. Mm-hmm. But I thought, okay, this is, you know, a country where they sponsor chess tournaments from time to time, and so maybe I should actually take one for the team. And I gave my price, and then they wanted to haggle about the price, and I was just, no, I'm not available. And they say, okay, mm-hmm. we agree the first price. I'm like, no, you misunderstand. I just can't do this. I think making such decisions now it's easy because I have enough money to pay the bills, but when I was younger and didn't have enough money to pay the bills, and I also made similar decisions that mm-hmm. I didn't want to do something that was wrong, felt wrong. I think some of the confidence to do that has probably also come from Mark and. Mm-hmm. And knowing that you can live like this, you don't have to chase financial gains and outer success.
Yeah, and the connection with a pupil, it has to be a fit, otherwise it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and it also has to be the right time. You can have a great personal relationship with a student, but maybe you're not the right person at this time. And I had this experience recently where I sort of got the feeling that I was standing in the way of the progress of a student who's Nordbeck Abdusatorov. And, you know, when I resigned and my job with him, my contract with him, he was like, but why? You know, like, mm-hmm. and I'm saying, I don't think it's right for you. No, but we didn't break the rating records. Come on, we need to.
Yeah,
we have work to do. And I said, yeah, but I don't think I'm the right person. I think you should achieve all these things, and I'm not the right person to help you. And for personal reasons, you could see it could have been very attractive for me to continue working with him. It's deeply interesting to working with maybe the greatest talent we have in chess right now. Always entertaining, and he's such a pleasant person, as you will know.
Yeah.
I'm a student of Matreski. We don't measure it in that way.
No, but maybe you can try to be a bit more specific, Jacob, because I interviewed Nordbeck a couple of weeks ago, and he spoke about your work together, and he said, okay, you taught him to look at chess in a different way, and one that he was very appreciative of, and that he learned a lot from. Why did you feel that you had come at the end of this story? Because as you say, I mean, he is a fabulous player.
I have to walk a tight rope here because there's a lot of confidentiality to that part. Obviously, I don't want to talk about about Nordibek's play and so on.
Sure.
It's just the I felt the rhythm of the training. It he really needed some additional things. I think he needed additional inputs. He needed additional perspectives. Mm. And I do me. You know, I continue doing what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And if that emotionally and mentally was the right time for him at that time, which it could be, you know, you could imagine another player at the same level, but emotionally a slightly different place, it could be the right thing for him. I don't think the chess itself was wrong, but I think the approach doesn't fit well with how he needs to grow also as a human being at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it turns out I have some very interesting things I'm going to do next, which we can talk about another time. But at the time, I actually felt like, okay, I will finish this contract and then finally have some peace and quiet for, no big projects.
Yeah.
That also played in, of course. But I wouldn't have done it if I felt that I sort of abandoned him.
Mm-hmm.
On the contrary, it started with me thinking that I don't think this is the right thing for him at this very moment. And then being a little sad about it. And it's sort of like if you break up with with a girlfriend, but it's 3 weeks until you see her and you sort of, you're over it by the time you actually break up with her. That's sort of how it happened, because he was playing Weigand Say, and I thought, okay, I sort of was over it by the time we were talking about it.
Yeah,
But for him, it just happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're speaking about, well, let's say a player growing as a person. One quote in the book that I liked a lot was from Alexander Mochilov, where he says, in his main students, Yusupov, Dumatov, Zhvakintsev, one and the same style is felt. All of them are educated, intelligent, honest people, incapable of meanness. In terms of chess, they are all deep, thoughtful, and do not like conflict. And I'm thinking about these people, I think, yes. And that why he says that maybe that is one of the reasons why he never produced a world champion, because then you have to add some, well, let's say, meaner aspects in your character.
Yeah, I think, you know, a world champion has to walk through a graveyard consisting of his colleagues and friends. It does require a special kind of personality. And when you look at the young players at the moment, so let's just take the 5-6 most promising talents now.
Mm.
We have, I sort of want to count Firusha out, because even though he's playing the candidates, he seems like he doesn't have the thirst for it.
Mm-hmm.
So if he gets it, I absolutely accept he has the talent and possibilities, and you know, on a personal level, I like him quite a lot. But otherwise, we have Gukas, we have Pragnananda, we have Abdusatorov, we have Irigaisi, and we have Kemar. And all of them individually are exceptionally nice people. And you could maybe have said that about a lot of players at the age of 20. but at the age of 30, you have changed your opinion, and they probably also have changed a lot of people. And I do think that there is a tendency for a person to sort of have a bigger selfishness and willingness to walk through a graveyard of not only opponents, but also abandoned promises to wives and friends and so on, where you have to choose the world championship before anything else. And I think, I think Dretschke never had someone who was good enough to do it. Mm. But Yusupov was number three.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he really was number three. And there were these two highly complex people who have given a lot to the world, have given a lot to chess, and also have been in many, many conflicts, which was Karpov and Kasparov, and who sort of are somehow too great to be judged by traditional means.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very complex characters, grew up in also very complex circumstances, and had the willingness to fight to take it all the way to the top. And you had to fight with every inch of your being to do it. And hopefully you don't quite have to do that in our age as a world champion, for sure. And Nan seems like his path was less full of conflicts. Maybe he was a greater talent than the two others, and then still struggled with them. I don't know. It's this is very complex.
But it's one of the things that surprised me a lot from Kasparov at the time. I spoke to him on the eve of his match against Kramnik in 2000, and well, he was very fond of Kramnik and he admired his talent, and he said our relations are so good. And I said, so what's going to happen to those relations after the match? And he says, oh, they will be fine. They will be fine. I said, dream on. I mean, something is going to be destroyed. And of course, destroyed. I thought it was weird that he expected this.
Kramnik, he had to definitely destroy his relationship with Shirov to play the match. So I don't really want to go into to debating him, but when you lose a qualifying match and then are quite happy to go and play and say it's nothing to do with me, that's already is a choice where you choose that this is more important than other considerations.
Well, that was a complex matter.
It's a long, complex matter. Yeah. But let's say you would never have seen Dolmatov, Yusupov, Svaginchev, or Inakiev do this. You just wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And there are many other players you probably wouldn't have seen. I don't think you would have seen Gelfand do it. Or Anand actually declined the match, so we know he wouldn't do it either. I think this is sport everywhere. When it's fought to the absolute edge, and when the differences are very, very small, somehow who is willing to take it the most, who's most eager to take it, is sometimes the one who wins. It's brutal. Sport's brutal. It's got winners and losers. I don't think that is actually a universe that Mark was very comfortable in. He liked the training because there everyone's a winner.
Yeah, and maybe the big battles they are cruel, and maybe they didn't fit in with his personality. I mean, he was one other quote that I liked a lot was from Oleg Pervakov, the great study composer. He said
one of the three greatest study composers of our time.
Yes, and he said Arthur Schopenhauer wrote, "Happy is he who discovers his inner wealth." And I would add, and shares it, like Mark Tveretsky. I mean, this wish. But at the same time, it was also what I found interesting, what his wife, Inna, said. She said at some point, Mark had a rare combination of high intelligence, efficiency, and decency, which always aroused respect. Much can be forgiven for this. For example, he didn't own a hammer and other tools useful in the household. And now it comes, Jacob says, and in general, he was not at all interested in life. And then, of course, she's speaking about everyday life.
It didn't jump out. Like, of course he didn't have a hammer. Why would he have a hammer?
Yeah.
Like, supply him with a drill and you can might as well call an ambulance. This is not how he was. He was an intellectual, and also he was lazy, you know.
Yeah.
It's but But this sharing thing, I sort of want to address, and because I was not sure how to tell this story, because I think we could very easily come into just talking about how great he was, and he was,
yeah.
And I loved him immensely, you know, and this is sort of a story I've only told people in private, where, you know, you can get the context, and I would never have told it while he was still alive. But around 2000, this would be 2005 specifically, I sort of started doing mining for positions and looking and analyzing and sort of doing what I've been doing now for 20 years. And I found a number of nice positions, and Dretschke had shown me a lot of positions and always been very generous. And I thought, okay, here I have these nice positions. So I'd email them to him as exercises, and then, you know, that he could maybe use with his students. And then he put them in an article he wrote for E3, E5, the website.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of thought, that's a bit weird. Like, you know, like, I share what I have, my work, but it doesn't mean you can sort of publish it. And then I read the article, and the article was about various things, and it was about Inner Kiev, who had just won the Higher Russian League, which is the Open Russian Championship, and performed really, really, really well. And apparently, the way I read it was like part of the training that they had done was Inner Kiev had been solving these positions. But, you know, I'm not mentioned anywhere.
Mm.
Okay, so I emailed Mark and said, "Oh, is it? Do I understand this right? Did you use the material I sent to train in Kiev before the Russian Championship?" And he replied back, "The material in Kiev that trained us is in my article," which was like, sort of like it became his material because I sent it to him. And I thought, okay, whatever, you know, I just never did it again. But there's this sharing thing where, you know, you have to understand later on, because I never complained to him about it, never any conflict. I just thought, okay, I won't do that again. And it was not so much. It really was not so much. But then, you know, when it comes to, okay, you have this great idea for a book, and, you know, I'm thinking of doing so. Yeah. Send me your outlay. I send the outlay. Oh, no, you also need to include this. You need to include this. It's very important to talk about traps and and so on. So it's like the sharing is mutual. But like if you come to his house and there's food out, he would expect you to take it. Mm. He comes to your house and there's a cake, he will probably eat it.
Yeah.
And you know, and he was, you know, I did the training camps various places, and you know, when we were in Copenhagen, that's my own coach from childhood, you know, biggest chess fan there is. You know, invite him over for dinner together with Mark, and they sat and spoke for hours, and the guy was so happy. And for Mark, it's just like, oh, there's this nice guy, I spoke to him for some hours, it was nice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, no snobbery, no nothing. So in the right perspective, yeah, this sharing thing, but it went both ways. So.
Yeah. No, that's great.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. With the DGT electronic chessboard, millions of chess lovers can follow chess tournaments live. At-home chess fans use the boards to play online or play against chess computers with the same boards that top players use in tournaments all over the world. Play like a pro with a DGT board.
But you know it's on the other hand, you know, he would praise anyone like who deserved it, even surprisingly. Mm. I remember one of the first time I visited him, we were talking about books and so on. He said, "Oh yeah, there's this nice little book," and it took out a book by Byron Jacobs, which I think had sold like 8 copies or something. Mm. And I knew Byron. I worked with him at Everyman at the time, And I told him about the book. You know, Mark was very happy with it when I came home, and he's like, I didn't think anyone had read that book, you know. It's like, so I said, yeah, I liked it, and Dreske liked it. He said, yeah, okay, that's some people at least. Yeah.
Well, let's speak a bit about his books. Well, generally, from what I hear, people think that his Endgame Manual is his greatest book, and I think you agree on that as well.
It is the greatest chess book.
Well, that clarifies that.
Yeah, I did write it in the foreword, which was published, I think, in three or four four of the editions. Yeah. But I was kicked out, replaced by Vladimir Kramnik, which is why, of course, I spoke so badly about him earlier.
No, but you did mention it in the obituary that you wrote about Mark Tveretsky for New in Chess in 2016.
Yes.
Why is that book the greatest book, chess book, in your view?
So what it achieves is it does a lot of things at the same time. First of all, it's sort of a 220 position you must know to sort of make a little comparison with another book, where the way it was at the, I can't remember how they do it in the fifth edition, but in the first four editions, part of the text was in blue. And that one, if you just read that, that was easy accessible information for players at any, let's say, reasonable level. They now we have this huge influx, and it's fantastic. This huge influx of players who are like 1,000 rated, 1,100 rated online, who enjoys chess, and it's great. It's not quite for them, but 14, 15, 1600, mm-hmm. you can just read that, and you can get a lot out of it. Mm-hmm. And then you had these tragic comedies, which shows you actually. These things may be simple to understand when I explain it, but yeah, here in the Endgame Manual, uh-huh. you have tragic comedies also, where you have Shirov and all kind of players messing up these positions, and I think a lot of the players didn't like it so much because it was sort of like a ha-ha, look at these guys presented in that way, which was not the intention. The intention was to show like this is actually really difficult, even if it's simple. And here we have these great players failing. And I understood from that later, you know, when I also explain games where people make mistakes, I explain that you have to have a delicacy because people can easily feel personally criticized while Mark would probably think, no, this shouldn't be so sensitive. Of course, I'm talking about chess. Mm-hmm. Like he would maybe not have that sensitivity, but anyway. So you had these examples where you can see, okay, this is actually really difficult. These players who we know are absolutely amazing messed it up. And then you had exercises. So a strong player could also sit and use this training at a high level. The selection of it across was, because it's like 220 positions and ideas, you can always say there's something missing because there's only 220. But it was basically a professional education in endgames, endgame theory specifically. There was also a bit about practical play, but mainly endgame theory. And I just hadn't seen anything done to that level before. I tried to do the same with practical endgames in a book called A Matter of Endgame Technique, which you haven't read. I am even not sure my proofreader read it. And there were pages returned that had no marks on it. I think he skipped them, which was 896 pages. But in only 400 pages, Dreske managed to do all of endgame theory at an exceptional accessible level, and at the same time at the depth where I heard Christian read the book many times, and I know many other strong players who read it a number of times. You know, like, how can you achieve all of those things at once? I don't know of any other chess book that does it. But there's the follow-up here, and pardon me for going into a personal story. I wrote a book called Practical Chess Defense in 2005. It's sort of my first book as a, let's say, graduated at a master level in chess writing. The excelling books were sort of my bachelor books under the supervision of Drechsel University. And then Practical Chess Defense was sort of unique. I had gone through these 5,000 exercises, combinations from Chess Informant. And I had found out that a lot of them had issues and really exceptional defensive ideas. And then I added maybe a few extra examples, but essentially that was the core of the book. And then I had these exercises. A lot of them was quite difficult. And to this day, the people will tell me that it's my best book. Gelfand holds that opinion. And Dresky, when I met him, not long after it published, said, congratulations. Congratulations. You published the most difficult chess book in the history of the game. Until my next one. So this guy was very competitive. Yeah, you know, yeah. He liked being referred to as the best trainer in the world. He was, yeah. But he also enjoyed being it. Yeah. And the next book was the analytical manual, and it is unreadable. It is the Finnegan's Wake of chess literature. Where, you know, Umberto Eco said Finnegan's Wake is the ultimate postmodern masterpiece. The hero is the reader if he makes it to the end.
Yeah. That's a beautiful comparison.
It is sort of a book for that is like, you get this position, you have to think for an hour, and then you make a decision, and then you turn the page, and now you have to think for another hour. Yeah, it's impossible. There was, I think I don't betray a confidence, where to say it was Judit Polgár told me, we were talking about it, and she said, it's just so difficult, I don't see the point.
Yeah.
The greatest athlete of any sport at all times says, I don't see the point, it's too difficult.
Well, maybe this is a good moment to think about this. I mean, there's no denying about Mark's legacy. I mean, he's written so many great works. Is there enough in it for, let's say, the average player? I mean, is there a way you can read his books that they are also become valuable for a lesser strong player?
Like, one of my dreams was always to be a publisher of Mark Drechsel, and I never achieved it. We sort of, at the time when he offered me to be his English language publisher, I couldn't afford it, to be honest. And it's not sour grapes when I say these books are advanced. This is difficult books. This is books that I find challenging. And I'm not so weak. So I think if people are not afraid to get beaten up a bit by them, they can be very valuable. And if you approach the endgame manual and simply read the parts that are readable and skip whatever seems to be challenging, I think you get a lot out of it. But this is where I sort of got my best possible revenge, because I am the publisher of the Yusupov series of these 10 beautiful books, which is the Drechsel system for the average player.
Yeah,
it really is. It is. You know, I cannot read this without seeing it. And you also have a book which is sort of the Drechsel system for the average player with New in Chess. And I'm not even sure you know this story. So in the mid-70s, Drechsel, he gave a series of lectures on practical endgames in Moscow. And there was one of the people who were attending it, asked him, so when is the book coming? Mark was like, I can't be bothered writing a book. There was 15 years at least before he actually published a book. And the guy said, oh, do you mind if I write it? No. Here, you can see my notes. So, okay, he then added some things of his own, like on two bishop and pass pawn and so on. But essentially, this is the cornerstone of Krzyzewski's endgame strategy. Now you have the Krzyzewski method, you call it,
yeah.
Sort of like adding a lot of extra things to what was in the past your sister company, Everyman. They had endgame strategy. And this way you could say the for the club player, the average player, the accessible Krzyzewski books are my own Excelling at Chess calculation, which was very much influenced by him, which is from 2004, published by Everyman. Then there's the Yusupa books, which were extremely influenced by Krzyzewski, and there are 10 of them. Again, the reading order is orange, blue, and green. We really messed up the numbering of these. You can see it on qualitychess.co.uk. You can see there's sort of a link where you can see how to read them, but it's very easy. It's orange, blue, green. And then there is Endgame Strategy. And these are the accessible Krzyzewski books. And I always recommend them. And so with relation to excelling as a chess calculation, which I sort of forgotten about until now, this was also highly influenced by lectures by Krzyzewski in Denmark. And, I was very happy when I invited him for a lecture later in Glasgow, and people were asking about his system. Oh, you can just get Jakob's book. You know, it's all there. So it's sort of like, and we had conversation about it, where I said, well, Mark, you're a trainer, I'm a writer, I think I just made it easily accessible. Yeah, you're entirely right. I don't know how to write. And still he wrote the greatest books, yeah?
I think that's a wonderful moment to unfortunately finish this conversation, Jakob. I enjoyed it a lot.
I'm out of bullets, so it's good.
No. But I mean, we touched on many things, and it was great to hear your memories of Mark and the way his work influenced yours and the other way around. And I would like to thank you for that. And I'm sure there will be other occasions when we have to go into other matters. But for the moment, this was a great conversation about Mark Dvoretsky on the occasion of the publication of the book.
I'm looking forward to see you in person in the near future. You know,
we
can go and see AC/DC together in Amsterdam.
Did you get the tickets?
Not yet, but they are sort of with the Sharks now. You have to pay 50% more, and then you can get some. That's how it works these days.
Yeah. Let's see how that goes. I look forward to that, Jakob. So, thanks again. And, we'll definitely be in touch.
Thank you very much.